Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Doug Kilby, your host. I'm here with Grant Rudmadunst.
Hey, Doug, how you doing this evening?
Good. We're on for another show tonight. We've got Robert Collins with us this evening. We're going to be talking about UFOs and the cover-up and on, interesting topic. And so we'll get to that in just a moment. If you'd like to join us in the chat room, you're probably there. If you'd like to be able to type in, just log into Blog Talk Radio there. If you want to call in, we take calls. The numbers are on your screen. You can also use the Skype button or the click to talk button if you have a computer and if you have a headset with your computer. So if you have questions, we're here and we got answers. And even if we don't know, we'll come up with something, or at least Grant will.
Yeah, we'll try anyway.
So tonight our guest is Robert Collins. He was a career Air Force officer serving in the fields of avionics, ground communications, engineering, physics, and intelligent out of the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson. He gained an in-depth understanding of all the career fields. After 22 years, he left public service to pursue the subject of UFOs full-time, living on Air Force retirement, supplemented by odd jobs. It's our pleasure to have Robert with us tonight. Welcome, Robert.
Well, welcome. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah.
It's nice to have you with us tonight. We're really excited about you coming on the show and discussing a book that's getting a lot of publicity right now and a lot of favorable reviews, and we're hoping you can tell our audience a little bit about it because we're awful excited to, you know, have you here to discuss it.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I hope I can answer at least a few questions.
Well, what got you started in the field of ufology?
Well, it actually, the interest in I had in the subject was back at age 12 when I read a lot of books related to the subject, but then I kind of dropped the whole thing until I got in the Air Force, and then finally got through college when I was enlisted, and then I got the commission out of that enlistment, and then I went to graduate school at Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson, and then right from there I went to the Foreign Technology Division, which was a sort of a rock's throw from where the graduate school was. So I stayed at Wright-Pat and went to graduate school, and then I went to the Foreign Technology Division.
That's interesting.
What were you specializing in graduate school, Robert? Were you like...
The degree program was called Engineering Physics.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was specializing in laser optics, and we touched on areas of plasma and nuclear physics.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that largely related to weapons research or propulsion? Or?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, sure. All the programs in the, especially at AFET, which is their graduate school for the Air Force. In fact, is they have the Army and the Marines and the Navy go to the Air Force Graduate School because the
mm-hmm.
other services really, except for the Navy, doesn't have a graduate school. And, of course, the Army has an undergraduate school, and, of course, the Navy has their academy, but they really don't have any graduate school. So they use the Air Force Graduate School for their undergraduates.
So how did you – were you interested in like how – UFOs might have been propelled yourself, or was did that kind
no,
of your interest
you know,
in UFO lead you into that part?
No, they say that you stumble into something or stumble into things. Well, that's what happened to me when I got to the FTD, which is the Foreign Technology Division. I was just sitting in the office one day chit-chatting with the fellow analyst and brought up the subject of UFOs and started talking a lot about it and heard all those rumors about alien bodies being a right path. And one thing led to the other, and one of the analysts, in fact, his name was Richard Clark. You don't know him, but he was a friend of mine back then. And he said, you ought to talk to a certain Ernie Kellerstrass. And Ernie had retired two and a half years before I got there. So he one thing led to another, and I finally got a hold of Ernie, and then all of a sudden the world kind of opened up, and all the things that were going on, because Ernie was just full of information that went all the way back to the 1950s and his experiences with the UFO subject, and went throughout the world and the things that he had done. So going to Ernie it led to put me in contact with one thing led to the other, I should say, and it put me in contact with Bill Moore, and then of course Bill Moore eventually it led to Jamie Shander and Rick Doty and some other players in the field, and one thing just led to the other, and so the whole thing just kind of grew.
Was there any truth to the rumors about underground when you were at Wright-Patterson? Is there an underground complex?
Yeah, there is, and we've got the evidence to back that up. We've got, not only do we have what witnesses, and of course Ernie Kellerstrass gave us an extremely good and thorough breakdown of this underground complex and where the entryways were and how you got in and where the vaults were located behind certain buildings. And through that, and then through the efforts of civil engineering at Wright-Patterson, we were able to dig out a lot of the pertinent information related to these vaults and exactly where these entryways were and how they were sealed up before everything was moved out of Wright-Patterson in the early 1980s.
So where did they relocate everything, Robert? The rumor, the UFO folklore. The UFO folklore says that maybe the aliens that were from the crash at Roswell were stored there, and that was the reason for the special underground vaults and yada yada.
Well, the vaults weren't put there because of Roswell. They were there before Roswell occurred. And they were built according to all the photographic people of the squadron and some other people that we talked to, plus the information coming from the civil engineering people said that the vaults were actually built in the 1930s to house nitrate film, which is considered very volatile and explosive. You want to put these vaults in a deep area where it's cool, where it doesn't require refrigeration, but it's just naturally cool there. And so they built these vaults back in the mid 30s, and a lot of them were pretty good size. And when the Roswell occurred, all they did was take some of these vaults and convert them into storages for the bodies they retrieved at Roswell.
Why did they decide to move everything from Wright-Patterson?
Security leaks. This is considered the most sensitive, classified. That's a really catchphrase. I would say to myself, they classified aliens. Isn't that amusing? They considered this to be the most sensitive classified subject in the U.S. government, and when all those rumors were circulating about alien bodies being at Wright-Patterson, eventually it got to a point where they had to move things and to keep the security on the subject, so they moved the items out of Wright-Patterson, according to all our sources, somewhere probably in 82 and 83.
And where'd they go, allegedly?
Well, several places were mentioned. One was Los Alamos, of course, and then Area 51. And then there's a couple NSA facilities, too, that they supposedly have artifacts stored near the facilities.
So you've got a new book out, right? The same name as the program? Exempt from Disclosure.
Sure, it's called Exempt from Disclosure. It's a third edition, and it's been revamped, it's been cleaned up, it's been simplified, because a lot of people found the first couple editions too difficult to read because of the technical nature of the subject. It's not a book that you'd get, if you were just getting into the subject, that you want to get into. It's very scientifically oriented. It's got a lot of footnotes, and it's got a lot of references to back up everything that's being said in the book.
And so where can people get a copy of the book? From your website?
They can go to Amazon, or just put in the Google search engine, just put Exempt from Disclosure, and it will pull up the third edition for you.
Cool.
When did the first edition come out, Robert?
2005.
Okay.
So let's talk about some of the things that you found along the way here since 1985 when you started investigating. What are some of your, where have your travels taken you? What are some of the interesting things that you've learned?
Well, it's the meetings that we had beforehand, up leading from starting from about 1986, what they termed the aviary. That was composed of 10 or 12. It would depend on the day and the week and the time, but it would vary depending on the number of people that would show up in any one meeting. And we're talking meetings from anywhere from that occur from Dayton, Ohio, down through New Mexico, in motel rooms and in parks. In Dayton, Ohio, they were in a state park. We didn't set that up. Ernie set that up because he wanted security. You know, and the state park was a good place to be, no mics around to hear what we were saying.
Huh.
So we had all types of, in all different situations and all types of meetings with different types of people. And again, depending on, who could get to the meeting at any one time, they were all over the country. And most of the time we spent thousands of hours talking on the phone with each other, which is much easier than trying to get together for meetings.
So you had reason to believe that the government was spying on you, so to speak?
Well, I have the phone taps here to prove them, that there were phone taps on this phone. And even today, the methods of surveillance are so different today. They're a lot more sophisticated than they used to be back in the 80s and 90s. The corporations supply the National Security Agency with just about anything they want that can either suck up phone calls or emails at a phenomenal rate. The analysts, the hired analysts they have there at NSA can't keep up with it.
So you think the government officials who are listening in on us now will promote our program?
They could be. More than likely, they listen. They listen and suck up all the information. It's like collecting intelligence for them. They want to find out what everybody else is doing, and they know what the answers are, and they want to find out what you're doing.
Do you think, Robert, that what do you think the general? We seem to get so much disinformation, and there seems to be just tons of it, and little kernels of information in there. What changed in the last few years that wanted you to want to do some of those revisions, aside from the fact that you say that there's a lot of technical stuff in there? Was there anything that new that had come to light that you really felt had to be included in this edition of the book?
The NSA people that were involved in decoding a Hebrew text that supposedly was recovered this comes from Tim Cooper's father, by the way. He got an award in 1963 mm-hmm. from Curtis LeMay for his participation in the UFO program. This is 1963. And that citation is official and appears in a book by Bob Wood, Bob and Ryan Wood. But anyhow, right. This citation for Tim Cooper's father, that supposedly there was a Hebrew pitch recovered from an ellipsoid or elliptical-shaped object buried in the sand in New Mexico in March of 47, well before Roswell.
Really?
And this thing was deciphered and read by a couple people, NSA analysts, by the name of Calamos and Freeman, who also probably were involved in decoding the Alien Codex, which is depicted in a 1962 JFK MJ-12 memo. So it seems like these two NSA analysts were involved in both deciphering this Hebrew text, which they said predated the Hebrew of Moses, and also at the same time they were able to decode the Alien Codex.
What did it tell them?
Pardon me?
Do you know what it said? Do we have any idea what the message was?
No, I have no. It was just enough to figure out that these guys were actually involved in this stuff, and putting the bits and pieces together. Of course, the decryption of the codex, the Alien Codex, is probably extremely classified and kept secret by NSA.
So to sum this up, that you're saying that there was a saucer discovered in March of 1947 in New Mexico.
Yeah, well, according to the stories that were, you know, this is bits and pieces, and this depends on just a few individual sources who say that there was something that they discovered this at Alamogordo Army Air Force Base at the time, which was, it's located very near that. But this thing was fuzzy. Buried in the sand, and it wasn't flying, it was just buried in the sand. And they discovered this elliptical object by accident. And when they dug this thing out and were able to get into it, they found a copy of a Hebrew text, they say, that was older, it had Hebrew in it that was older than the Hebrew of Moses.
So was the saucer there a long time? I mean, it had been there?
Well, that wasn't stated as to how long it had been there, but they assumed it had been there for quite a while based on the age of the sand formations.
Was the activity that seemed to spike around Roswell at that time, was that because of the 509th bomb group there at Roswell? Or, you know, I know that a lot of folks subscribe to the fact that, you know, the aliens have, been observing or interacting with us for thousands of years, maybe even manipulated us genetically. But was there any particular reason for that spike in activity? I mean, some people have theorized that they were trying to retrieve the people that they'd lost in the crash. Is there a new slant on it that you know of, Robert?
Well, speculation about that, and then again, it's just speculation. I said that our atomic bomb test is what drew the attention, and that's what drew the what caused such an upsurge in UFO sightings was the testing of our nuclear weapons.
Do you think, you know, there's another part of UFO folklore that you're probably familiar with, and when I say that, I don't say it in a denigrating manner at all, is that we entered into a devil's agreement, you know, with the aliens, and I think it was the Eisenhower meeting at Vandenberg Air Force Base in the 1950s, where supposedly we were approached by different groups of aliens. Is there any truth to that? Have we entered a devil's agreement with these guys?
Was that Vandenberg or Edwards?
Maybe it was Edwards. That was one where you were supposed to have had a toothache, and maybe I'm getting too confused.
That was Edwards.
Yeah.
All I understand about that is he had some meetings with supposedly Paul Blount at the time. They didn't like our B-58s because they had nuclear
weapons.
That story right, yeah.
Yeah, basically, and they just said that, you know, they said to us, in return for technology, what we'll do is that we want you to give us your nuclear weapons. And they just said, you know, I kind of said, no, I don't think so. And then later on, where they were approached by another group that said, look, we don't care. You let us abduct a group of your people, or your people to do genetic experiments on or whatever we want to do, and we'll give you the technology. And I think a lot of people are under the impression that maybe that happened. I'm not so sure, but...
Well, I agree with you. I'm not sure of that at all. I have never heard of an agreement like that except in the rumor mills. And
yeah, that's kind of out there in the lunatic fringe. But, you know, I was just kind of curious if you know, being part of the Air Force Intelligence Network, that if you guys have ever heard anything like that.
No, I never come across things like that, although... I've heard stories about human hybrids and kind of interaction with human hybrids, but that's about the extent of...
Well, the only reason I brought that up is because a lot of people use that as a hinge point for saying that's one of the reasons why there's no disclosure whatsoever.
Well, I think the aliens from the abduction counts and some of these abductees have been saying, I think the aliens have been saying that, but I don't think the U.S. government's been saying that. I know the aliens have told the abductees that, you know, we're exchanging your DNA for our technology. Yeah, I've heard those stories from abductees, but I haven't heard them from any U.S. government source.
So then, and maybe you come across it in your new book, is the reason why the government isn't straightforward with us about what's going on is because either, one, they're using it as cover for new technology that they're developing, or number two, they're completely in the dark just like we are?
First of all, it's the technology. The government has no control over this. None. Zero. They have no control over any alien groups that can sit there and pretty much do what they want. The second consideration is most of this recovered hardware now has been transferred to private corporations. So that it's not the U.S. government anymore. It's private corporations that are keeping the secret.
Mm-hmm. So they can keep it in the dark?
Well, they sure. So they want it for their own ends, of course. You know, of course, if you can reverse engineer it and you can market it, you can make lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think the alien agenda is?
I think they want to carry on. I think they're still carrying on with a lot of these abductions covertly. I think, as I said, the U.S. government doesn't want to let this stuff out to the public, and I think the aliens can do it at any time they want to. They can get to a place and make a grandstand and play up the band and bring out the colors and the stripes or whatever you want to call them, and just and put on a show and say, here we are. They can do it at any time, and as far as what they haven't done it yet, I have no idea why they haven't done anything yet. Maybe they don't want to do it. Maybe they find out the abduction programs are too productive and too fruitful, and they're getting somewhere with them, and they just want to maintain a covert operation.
What do you think their goal is in the abduction programs?
To create a race of alien human hybrids.
And how long do you think this has been going on?
Oh, I would say at least since the early 70s, or maybe before. Or perhaps as far back as the 60s or even the 50s.
Are we dealing with one group in particular, Robert, or are we dealing with more than one group? Because there's been a lot of people that have come forth, similar backgrounds to yourself, and said we're dealing with 57 different races, and there's all kinds of folks out there. And so if that's the case, I guess we got to work hard to try to figure out who's the good guys and who's the bad guys.
I've heard of hybrids with what they term the gray types,
mm-hmm.
of course, as everybody else has. And then I've also heard of hybrids with these mantis type aliens, where their mantises are actually trying to crossbreed with humans, producing some pretty gross looking creatures from what the pictures and drawings I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever kind of try to figure out what technology they may be using to get here? Are we talking about interstellar? Are we talking about interdimensional? I mean, what's the state of our black projects right now in terms of how advanced are we?
We're not. If we're still planning, if we've still got plans for putting men on the moon with rockets and going to Mars with conventional technology that we have, we're not too advanced in terms of understanding the alien technology. In fact, is what sources have told me over the years is that we're having a terrible time with the materials and the propulsion system of these craft.
Mm-hmm. Well, even Bob Lazar said it would be the equivalent of dropping an SR-71 Blackbird into Civil War times and asking them to reverse engineer it.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's. I would say you wouldn't even have to go to the Civil War. I'd say just go back to 1920s.
Really?
You'd have the same problem. Yeah, you'd have the same problem because they wouldn't have a clue as to what a microjet was or a microstructure or laser guided or laser optics. They would be in the same situation. So the technology is way ahead of our current technology, and most of the stuff I understand. Well, Corso, if you remember,
yep,
Corso,
old Corso,
what,
yep.
what you describe in his books. Well, Corso was right when he said that we farmed a lot of this stuff out to private companies to try to reverse engineering. That part is
right.
Totally true. But what's not true is that we reversed a lot of this stuff already and put it into our own technology. Like he mentions the transistor. Well, there's no evidence that the transistor came from any type of alien technology other than our own technology.
Mm-hmm.
So he was right about some things, but he wasn't right about the fact that we have this marvelous new technology from what we recovered at Roswell and other crashes.
Well, I always thought the most interesting part of his book was when he talked about the night vision and how the aliens supposedly, that was like a film that they had over their eyes that they reverse engineered and figured out how to get the vision so they could see at night, and which was really fascinating because I think he talked about that being farmed out to 3M or whatever. But it's really interesting stuff. I guess the thing that fascinates me the most is, you know, even if there's not alien spacecraft out at Area 51, it certainly provided the Air Force with wonderful cover to do whatever kind of clandestine operations they want, because almost anything can be laughed off now as a UFO with a lot of negative publicity that's been going on out there with people just saying, you know, when they're looking at jets and they're thinking they're UFOs. That plays right into their disinformation campaign.
Sure. Yeah, well, sure, but of course, you know, again, you know, as it says, I don't know if you read the book or not, but it says in the book and tells you the levels and complexities of the compartmentalization that exists at Area 51. That you can actually be working there your whole life and never see anything that's alien.
Mm-hmm.
The Roadrunners are good examples of that, where they had their own containment area for their A-12s and SR-71s up north of the base. And they were in their own areas, and nobody was allowed in unless you had access. And they couldn't get into other areas unless they had access. And then you're compartmentalized.
Uh-huh.
And even when you show up in a cafeteria where everybody goes there to get food or sandwiches or go to a bar and get beer or something there, and they have their own bowling alley and all those resources at Area 51, just like any other base. You know, you're not, those guys that work in other places are not going to tell you a thing unless you had the access or need to know.
So in your book, I'm Exempt from Disclosure, what are some of the, what's the thread, what's the points that you're making in terms of situations or events? Or?
Well, it covers an entire breakdown of Wright Patton and all the entryways and tunnel systems and vaults at the base until, of course, now they're not being used. Then it goes into Los Alamos and breaks down the areas of Los Alamos involved in reverse engineering. Well, one entry was at TA-49. Of course, that's been closed off, and now they use another entryway from different tech areas. How the Dulce, actually called Dulce Complex at TA-49, and how it's structured and how they've got extremely controlled access. And even in those places, it's highly compartmentalized. Everything, even if you do have access to, say, certain alien things, certain subjects on the alien subject, or certain areas on the alien subject, you cannot gain access to any other area unless you have the need to know and the clearance to do so. So everything is tightly, highly controlled and highly compartmentalized. So, no person except for maybe the highest levels of the U.S. government and the president actually have a big picture idea of what's going on.
So again,
everybody else is so compartmentalized.
Has MJ-12 is it still in existence, in your opinion? And if so, how has it evolved over the years?
Because of all the leaks and because of all the information put out there and because of all these documents talking about MJ-12 had been put up on websites, they went through a reorganization around the end of 1999 and 2000, and now MJ-12 is no longer MJ-12. It has another caveat name, which is described in the book.
Uh-huh.
The two caveats are the report caveats they're now using instead of MJ-12. Let me put it this way. What they've done is they've gotten rid of the paper trail.
Uh-huh.
So now everything is on a computer. So if you, all this information is being stored on huge mainframe computers, and unless you have specific access and the right passwords and a need to know, you won't get into the files you need on that machine to do your work. And if you try to print anything out, say on a printer, well, they know who did it because the computer tracks that. So, you know, leaks are a lot harder now than they used to be, because back in the 90s, before they got everything on the machine, we had a lot of leaks, and now the leaks have come all dried up to next to nothing. It's because they've got all the stuff on a mainframe computer.
So to go back to Grant's question earlier, what's in your opinion, why is the government hiding all this?
Because it's a threat to their own political power. Because first of all, they can't tell the public they can't protect them. They can't sit there. They've got technologies and intelligence that's way over the top of anything they have they can possibly control and protect the public from.
Do you think that these aliens are a threat?
I think that some of them might be, and I don't think others are, but it's hard to know what's going on, because even these aliens in the abduction cases operate so covertly.
If we don't have, I mean, honestly, if the government cannot deal with them, if they can't fight them, if they can't control them, what difference does it make whether they disclose or not? I mean, human nature aside, I mean, if we can't control them, we can't control them. And so, really, the situation is no different now than it would be if they disclosed. You know, the only difference is we don't know. The public doesn't know. So, I mean, if it's been this way all along, why would the government...
Well, they might see it as completely upsetting, you know. If they go on the Brookings report, civilization is going to fall apart.
Well, we're going to reach a point like we did with, because things weren't done, or the right things weren't done, we had 9/11, and because other things weren't done, and the right things were not done, is because we had Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing is probably going to happen in this situation. There'll be some event, because the problem is dragged along for so long that something eventually will happen.
Uh-huh.
And it always happens that way. I don't know why the governments operate like that, and it's why we You know, if people had done their job, we would not have had 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
If people had done their job, we would not have had Wall Street. But people didn't do their job, and people are not doing their job on this subject, and eventually something probably will happen.
So do you think that the public should be made aware of the alien presence?
Well, sure, but I have no control over whether the public is aware or not aware. I don't know for, you know, the little things that you can do doesn't make, the public will ignore the problem just like the government does until it gets so bad they have to do something.
So, I mean, are you for disclosure, or, I mean, do you think we should?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, sure, well, yeah, but you know, the problem is, what do you do? Because you can't push a subject that people don't want to accept, and if they don't want to accept it, they're going to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always, and Doug and I have kicked this around, and I've always been of the ilk that, you know, 2 weeks after they announced that there were aliens, everything would go right back to normal the way it was. There would be everything, every news story, every news channel would have it on, and then it would die out, and everybody would go right back. There wouldn't be this gigantic paradigm shift, because most people are going to cling to what they hold dear. And, you know, if somebody comes in and really rattles your tree, well, they're going to go back to the things that they feel safest with. Of course, that's my opinion. I might be a little bit cynical. But, when we talk about them not wanting to disclose information, that's scarier than wanting to keep it secret, because it's just like,
mm-hmm.
that means that they don't know what's going on. And there are enough, if people are being abducted and we have no control over that and we don't know what the purposes of it is, but I would have to say, in my mind, anybody that's doing it covertly and doing it in that manner is not bearing me goodwill. And that's very worrisome.
Well, any kind of disclosure is, of course, a threat to any government in the world. I mean, it's a threat to their power. I think that the best people that can handle this kind of problem is the public. The public is more able. The public, in fact, is handling the current economic crisis better than the government.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming out with more innovative ways to try to create job situations and help other people much better than the government can do. And I think in this case, the public will probably do better than the government can do. And the government underestimates the public, and all the government is trying to do is protect their own power base and a potential threat to their own existence and their own power.
Yeah, but, you know, in all fairness to individuals like yourself who served our country and served it honorably, you know, there's folks that are really trying to do a good job. And you know, I think it's all too easy to just, you know, lump everybody and say everybody's, you know, like, you know, not having the best interest. And I'm sure there's a lot of hardworking guys out there in intelligence that are just trying to do the best they can. And, you know, probably feel that maybe disclosure is not the way to go because they adhere to the principles that it would be just too earth-shaking. And, you know, and besides, you know, why disclose if you don't have anything to help the public and tell them what's going on? You know, they certainly don't want to tell you that the people are snatched out of their beds and we can't do anything about it.
Oh, sure. Well, we didn't want to do anything about terrorists or potential terrorist threats.
Yes.
And all the red flags were there until something happened. And when something happens, then we want to do something. Or in the case of, you know, all the red flags were about Wall Street, and look what happened with Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's phenomenal. It's kind of, what happened with Wall Street is mind-boggling. How could so many people be so naive? But it reaches a threshold or a crisis point, and this stuff will eventually, I think, reach a threshold point where something on some level, and I can't be sure of the level, will trigger things off just like 9/11 did and Wall Street did.
So in your book, in addition to talking about some of the different bases and so forth, what does your book, I mean, what's the, you know, the direction of it, the objective of your book?
Well, the book covers the core of the cover up. It's not a, it covers the key people like Dulles and Helms, and of course Rick Doty and counterintelligence. It covers a certain group of key people that were at the core of the cover up, and it kind of revolves around those people. It's not a history book. It's not really a history of the subject. But it goes to the underlying drive that produced the cover-up.
So, what's the reality of the cover-up? Expanded nutshell.
It goes, it's how Dulles set up Area 51. That's what Watertown's named after the place he was born in. Watertown's another area for another name for Area 51, and it goes into Angleton and how he appointed Angleton in 1954 as chief of counterintelligence, and Angleton was involved in setting up MJ-12.
Yeah,
and how he was involved and how he set it up and what went on and the interplays between him and Dulles and Helms, and how they interplayed, and then of course the. Rick Doty was a good friend of the Helms family, Richard Helms, who was director of the CIA.
And everybody who's ever seen the movie The Good Shepherd, that was all about Angleton. That was supposed to be a takeoff his character, Master Helms.
Yeah, but it wasn't a really very, very good movie.
Oh, I know, but it was. Yeah, well, we know Hollywood takes, but basically it was a very rough...
Yeah, it was kind of distorted. It was distorted, the players didn't.
Let me ask you something, Robert, because you're a gentleman with an education and a background in physics, and how do you think these aliens are getting here? Do you think that they're traveling by interstellarly, or do you think they're traveling through dimensions, wormholes? What do you think? What type of methods are they using for propulsion?
Well, then again, that goes back to I have to rely on what all the intelligence sources tell me, and it's definitely of course I can say this, but of course people are going to believe it anyhow. It's not interdimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It is strictly interstellar, and they use something equivalent to what we call wormholes. Because they can get here in something like 61 days now from take Zeta Reticuli as an example. They use something which is called a negative force generating system, which is equivalent to an anti-gravity type system. Negative force generating system is your anti-gravity. In fact, is out there in the universe, you've heard about this dark energy pushing the galaxies apart. Well, that's the same basic principle that propels UFOs.
Okay, what's the structure the whole galaxy's hung on?
We're not going to fuse like the sun. So we're not going to anti-gravitate like the universe does. So what it's done is a series of superconducting materials and coils, and the craft itself, the UFO itself, is considered one big superconducting capacitor.
Uh-huh.
It acts, and the superconducting capacitor plus this high rotating, high spin assembly within the craft itself, which is composed of four spheres and a plate, and inside around this. Four spheres in the plate is a circular cylindrical tube which has got a superconducting electron plasma in it, and it's this spinning motion that's somewhere orders of 100,000 RPMs, which creates that high pitch humming sound, which creates that levitation or lift force or any gravity force that they talk about.
So it takes them 60 days to travel between Zeta Reticuli and here. Let's digress for a little bit. Tell us a little bit about Project Serpo, and how much of that do you believe was disinformation in retrospect?
Serpo, the basic core story about Serpo is covered in the book, and it takes up about a page and a half in the back, and that's all that could be generalized or broken down into the core information that is more than likely, based on what the sources are saying, is true. Everything else about SERPO is mostly just, from what we can tell, just made up or fabricated and created to confuse the subject and confuse the story.
Mm-hmm. But you think that there was some shred of truth to the fact that there was some sort of exchange at one point or another?
Sure, and every bit of disinformation, there's always a shred of truth.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you explain what SERPO is for our audience?
Well, supposedly, again, in 1965, let me backtrack from that. Let's say 1964, there was a meeting and it wasn't Holloman Air Force Base, it was Trinity, near the Trinity site, where the aliens made contact with the U.S. government, and that's when we got EB2 during that exchange at Trinity. The SERPO team the SERPO team didn't leave until 1965, and that was done in a designated place on the north area of Area 51, northern part of Area 51. It was supposedly, the story goes, there's two versions of the story. One is either it was 10 men and two women, or it was just 12 men. There's two versions of that story, and nobody can be sure which is the correct version.
So there was an exchange.
But it was an exchange, but our 12 people didn't leave until 1965. But we got EB2 in 1964, April 1964. But these 12 men went off to the Zeta Reticuli star system, and they didn't return until I don't remember what month it was until 1978. By the way, that's around the same time period that Spielberg had his Close Encounters of the Third Kind movie out,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. And of course,
that movie was supposedly based on that SERPO exchange program.
Well, you know, wasn't there supposed to have been, maybe you know something about this too, Robert, there was supposed to have been a film that was done at Holloman Air Force Base that they recorded the landing of a UFO and people stepping out of the UFO. Have you ever heard anything about that? And, you know, is there any truth to that they were filmed and there was this, I had read that people in Hollywood were contacted at one point in time about maybe releasing the film to the public, and then it all got kind of swept under the carpet. Have you ever heard anything about that?
Oh, well, yeah, sure. That whole Holloman scene took place at Trinity. That
mm-hmm.
was the Trinity contact in 1964. That Holloman story, according to what I was told or what sources have told me, Rick Doty's one of them, that Holloman story was disinformation. That was these counterintelligence people would go around planting these disinformation stories. And everything and anything that ever got said was distorted or lied about. And so you never knew what was true or not. But the Holloman story was the Holloman story was disinformation. But
okay.
the real contact took place at Trinity. I'm sorry, not Trinity itself, but just north of Trinity.
Here's a question from the chat room. Have you ever had an opportunity to see an actual UFO at one of the bases, perhaps that they were reverse engineering?
No, I never saw any UFOs in any base. And the only UFOs I saw were in over Phoenix, which were part of your Phoenix lights that they talked about, and also over the house here back in 1998, over the top of my house here in Dayton.
And another question, earlier in the show you'd mentioned something about photos and sketches of the alien-human hybrids. Are these public, and are they available somewhere?
They're up on the websites. A lot of abduction sites. There's WAA, Alien Abduction and Research, AAER, which is Marilyn Rubin's site. She has a lot of pictures up there of these so-called hybrids, and they're also
Mike.
At other websites. What's that?
There
are also
other websites. That was a little extract. I'm sorry.
There are also other websites, abduction websites, which have actually have lots of pictures of these hybrids.
Cool. So, all right, so we've got a few minutes left, got about 10 minutes remaining in the program. What message do you want to get out to the world from your work?
Oh, well, I think my message is pretty simple. All I'm trying to do is get the facts out. The facts as I know them, the facts that were told to me, the facts have been collected since about 1985, and try to make it cohesive and not go into any left or right wing or any type of wild speculation about what these things may or not be. And everything in the book is backed up by footnotes or references. So I try to stay out of the speculation as much as I can because it doesn't help. It does not help the subject.
So based on what research you've conducted and what you found out to be at least somewhat credible, what would you say the state of the UFO issue is? How do you see it? The whole thing?
Mass confusion. you've got a lot of frauds, you've got a lot of hoaxes, you've got a lot of people who just want to draw attention to themselves for whatever reasons and make up stories about things that they may or may never have happened. They have really shoddy evidence to support those claims, and it just creates a group of believers who want to believe that stuff. And then you've got other people who don't want to believe it, and what you've got is a lot of bickering and arguing going on.
Okay, so what's the reality of the UFO situation as you have come to understand it and believe it? Not so much with ufologists or what people are saying, but you know, from your research, what do you think is going on with the whole UFO issue?
Well, I as I said before, 40-some-odd minutes ago, it's an orchestrated cover-up. It will stay that way until things change or something or maybe somebody changes that. But it's an very orchestrated cover-up. Most of this stuff, as I said before, has been transferred into private contractors, and Monsanto is a good example. Monsanto is one of the contractors where a lot of this alien technology now is being held by contractors. And they're more, actually, if you think about it, they're more secretive than the government is.
Yeah, I would imagine. So,
and they're certainly not subject to the same laws. They could do whatever they wanted, pretty much, I think.
Sure. Which makes it more insidious because now you've got another layer added to the layer of secrecy. And if anybody's ever worked for contractors, you know how stringent the boss is.
So how many different races do you think are visiting the planet, species?
Well, right now I've been told up to 9 races, and there could be more. And don't ask me to name them all, but other than the ones that we're all familiar with.
Is it just one race that's abducting people, or is there more?
Well, you've got the reptoids have been reported in abductions, and I think the tall blondes have, and I think your short little grays have been reported, and I think the manis type aliens have been reported. I think that's about four.
Yeah.
Four different races, and there are probably more, but I cannot be sure of. Since abductions are not my expertise.
So, Bob, since you've done this, since you've written your book, what type of repercussions have you had, if any, since you know you initially published the first edition? Has the government leaned on you at all, or told you to clam up, or?
Well, a lot of my sources have withdrawn on me, and trying to beat them up and get them back, and. All of a sudden, the sources just clam up you and stop talking, and at one point they're very talkative, and then they just shut up. So, and then I've had myself criticized and beat up, and I've been accused of being a disinformation agent, and Doty was accused of being a disinformation agent, and But at the same time, if you think about that, Richard Dolan, you know Richard Dolan?
Yes.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, his book, he quoted the exempt from disclosure book from, what, page 138 to 565 in his book. So And then of course, Linda Howe, who likes to beat up on Doty, endorsed Richard Dolan's book.
So you're saying that he plagiarized your book?
Well, he used certain pieces out of the book that he didn't ask me about until after the fact. I didn't find out about until that stuff after the fact. But if he's quoting this book, and then Linda Howe, who loves to, at least in the past, loved to beat up on Richard Doty all the time, is endorsing the book, that's a big switch, I think.
So what do you think needs to happen in the UFO community in order to find answers? Anything in changes?
Well, I think people need to get along. There's so much competition going on. There's so much infighting, and there's so much turf grabbing that nobody shares information. Nobody cooperates, and it's just like if you want to make progress, you have to cooperate. I said, we don't need government disinformation. We've got public opinion, right?
Got the UFO community, huh? All right,
yeah,
well, tonight
they sit up there and they beat each other up all the time, but they don't get along.
Well, point well taken. Tonight we've been talking with Robert Collins, author of The Exempt from Disclosure, The Black World of UFOs. And you can get that book on Amazon.com. Just do a search for Exempt from Disclosure. We, on Paranexus.org in the archives, there's also a link to the website with your book on it. If you haven't been to Paranexus.org, we certainly invite you to join us there. Memberships are available. It is an organization that shares, an organization of great people, of great researchers who are serious about finding answers and are also serious about non-competition and serious about not fighting, because that's such a problem, not just in the UFO community, but in the paranormal.
Yeah, all the way across the board, unfortunately.
I mean, it's not any human institution, I would suppose, but we'd love to have you at Paranexus.org. If you're interested in taking courses, go to ParanexusAcademy.org. That's available, too. Working on the UFO course, which will be out here in a month or two. It's in pre-release right now. We also have an EVP course under development and a couple of others. So a lot of changes, a lot of benefits to being a member of Paranexus, web hosting for your anomalous research site. We have the research assistant with a lot of handy tools and information available to members. The members directory, if you conduct investigations, you can be listed there. Blogs and just a lot of good information, and as I said, a lot of good people. Robert, we really appreciate you taking your time to join us tonight.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to have you with us, and hopefully you'll be able to come back and visit us again sometime.
Well, it was very great talking to you guys. I tell you, it was a real easy time compared to some things.
Well, that's
guys,
a compliment.
Really great.
Yeah.
Well, we'd love to have
you guys
back sometime.
Yeah, you guys were really great, and it was, I think the conversation was really easy and went extremely well, really.
Well, thank you.
So,
well,
yeah,
we appreciate
so
you.
Was, yeah, very nice. Yeah,
thank
good,
you so very
night,
much.
Guys.
I really appreciate
yeah,
it.
Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We appreciate time from our listeners as well. If we didn't get to your question, I think we tried to get to them all, and if not directly, indirectly, we do appreciate your time and joining us. Next week, we have Psychic Perspective with our own Gregory Kent. He is going to have our Paranexus field investigator, Bonnie Korniak, on along with Janet, Psychic Medium. So join us next week for Psychic Perspective. We have some other good programs coming up as well.
Yeah, we got Frank Fischino coming back to
Frank.
Visit with us again.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen Frank in a while, and Frank was just recently on Monster Quest and did an update on the Flatwood Monsters, and we're looking forward to Frank. Frank was at the Paranexus conference, and he's a good friend of Paranexus. So we'll talk to him, and he always puts on a great show, and he's done some terrific research.
And just to be clear, the Flatwoods Monster is not a creature per se, but it's an alien. So if you're not familiar with that, you'll want to join us in a couple of weeks. So some good stuff coming up. Again, thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a great week, a great night.
the night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Paranexus Universe.